And please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Amy from Palmyra, New Jersey.
Wow, you guys like dim the lights. I feel like I have a spotlight on me up here. Hi, everyone. My name is Amy Shear. I am a recovered alcoholic.
Amen.
And I can only say that because I've been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're outlined in the big book. I have a sponsor who took me through those steps, and I have a loving God of my understanding, and I have the opportunity to work with other women. And that's what keeps me recovered on a daily basis. My sobriety date is April 17th, 2002. And I like to say, after I give my sobriety date, that although I've been sober for 11 years, I didn't start to recover from this disease until about 3.5 years ago. And I'll get more into that in a little bit. So my job here tonight is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Anytime I get asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I try to say yes. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. It's given me such a freedom that I never thought was even possible. So if I can even give an inkling of that back, to this program and to all of you, and to a God of my understanding, then I'm happy to do that. I want to thank Amber for putting my name in here to get me up here to speak. So thanks, Amber. And Sarah for asking me. I know she couldn't be here tonight. But so what it was like, you know what? I grew up in a small town in New Jersey, Cinnaminson, New Jersey. It's probably like 2 square miles. I have 2 loving parents. I have a brother. I never wanted for anything as a child. Nothing traumatic happened to me as a child that caused me to be alcoholic. I had parents that supported me and loved me, and I had a nice house and a good school that I went to. So I had a pretty normal childhood. My parents did get divorced when I was about 13 years old. That does not cause my alcoholism. Pretty normal childhood. In retrospect, I can look back and see that I was a child full of fear from a very young age. I can recall being on the school bus at, 5 or 6 years old and just being so full of fear of what the day was going to bring. You know, was the teacher going to call on me and I wasn't going to know the answer and look stupid in front of my classmates? Or was I going to be that kid in gym class that was the last one picked for the kickball team? Or was I going to be the kid on the playground that no one wanted to play with? And these are the things that went through my head all through that ride, that 5-minute ride to school, every day. And that was never the case. You know, I was always a pretty good athlete, so I was always picked first for the kickball team, usually before all the guys. I was a good student, so I usually knew the answer. And I had a lot of friends. So even though I felt so separated on the inside, it wasn't the case on the outside. And that was the big thing growing up, this sense of separation. You know, especially in my high school years, I can just remember having a lot of people around me, but always feeling like I was on the outside looking in. And then that day came, and I don't know how old I was when I took my first drink, probably 14 or 15. That day came that I took my first drink with some friends in the woods behind the school, and that fear went away. That sense of separation was gone. All of a sudden, I was part of. You know, I went from this ugly, unpopular girl that you really didn't want to be around to you were lucky to be around me. You know, that's what alcohol did for me. It gave me the confidence to talk to people. It made me feel more attractive. I could laugh. I could be free. Alcohol set me free from a very young age. And once I got a taste of that freedom, I didn't want to let it go. I didn't start drinking alcoholically in high school, but there's one thing that I know from the very beginning. I have never had one drink in my life. Never. Alcoholism does run in my family. I don't blame my family for my alcoholism. I love my alcoholism today, as crazy as that sounds. It's one of the greatest assets I think I have today. Back then, I wouldn't have said that. But, you know, for me, I believe that phenomenon of craving was there very early on. Because as soon as I put a drink in me, and whether that was because it gave me that freedom that I desired or because it was the phenomenon of craving, I don't know, but I knew that once I took that one, I wanted more. And by the time I was 18 years old, once I took that one, I had no power or control over how much I was going to take or when I was going to stop. And the spans between drinking got shorter and shorter and shorter. All my friends went away to college. I stayed at home, and I lived with Mom, and I became a victim. Poor me. All my friends are away at college having fun, and I'm stuck at home with Mom going to Rutgers in Camden. And I started drinking pretty much on a daily basis. You know, it wasn't like I was going out to bars and partying because I cared way too much about what people thought about me. So I knew what I got like when I drank, and I didn't want you judging me for falling down because that's usually what happened when I drank. Once I put alcohol in my system, I either drank until I passed out or I blacked out or whatever. But I had no control. So I was a very isolated drinker. I drank at home. I couldn't wait to get done my classes. So my mom used to buy the big jugs of, like, re-needy wine. So I used to, like, pour some out of that in, like, a big cup and take it back up to my room. And the jugs were so big, she wouldn't really notice that anything was missing. She eventually caught on. And then we always had a bar in the house that I would steal stuff out of. And then soon enough, I was 21, and I could just buy my own stuff. But by the time I was 21, I was a daily drinker. I was, you know, drinking to the point that I was passing out every night. And, you know, I guess at that time, I knew that my drinking was a little out of control. My friends were starting to graduate from college. They were going out and starting their careers. I actually did graduate from college, and I ended up getting a pretty good job. But every night after that job, I came home and I drank. And I would go to work drunk the next day because I would drink so much the night before. And I saw my friends starting to have this life, and I started questioning my own. Like, here I am living with Mom, going to a job, coming back, getting drunk every night. How am I going to change this? And I really thought that the solution was I needed to meet a man and get married. And the problem was there were no men coming knocking at my door, you know, asking me out. So my mom, I guess, was concerned about my life as well and decided she was going to fix me up on a blind date. And she did. And she fixed me up on a blind date with this man she knew from the Rotary she belonged to. It was a business organization. She fixed me up on a blind date with this man, and he was an incredible man. So incredible that within 3 weeks I moved in with him. And because he was going to be my solution. He was my way out. I was drinking because I was stuck at Mom's house, and I needed to grow up and have a life. So I moved in with him, and at that time I was able to curb my drinking a little bit. But it wasn't before long I was drinking pretty much on a daily basis with him as well. And it got to the point that he would say things like, Amy, I am not going to want to stay with you if you continue to drink like this. So that's when the hiding the drink started happening. You know, as long as he was out with me, I could drink the way I wanted because he liked to, like, drink on the weekends. But during the week, I was hiding my drinking. I would wait until he fell asleep, and then I'd go out to our fully stocked bar and, you know, drink in front of that. And, you know, I thought, well, there's something that's just not right yet. I'm just not happy. You know, I love you, I have you, but I think I need more, and I think we need to get married. If we get married, then I'll stop drinking. Well, I wasn't going to stop, but I was going to drink normally. So we got married, and my drinking just continued to progress. And I said, you know what I think it is? I think it's this job I have. It's the job. I need to switch my job. So I changed jobs, and my drinking continued to progress. And then it was, I think it's we're living in this condo, and I need a house. If I have a house, then I'll have a yard to take care of, and I'll have a house to clean, And so we bought a house. And all the while, my drinking kept progressing. And I didn't know it at the time, but here I suffered from this thing called a spiritual malady. I had this hole in my soul. I had this God hole, which I didn't know at the time that's what it was, that I was trying to fill with material stuff or human things. You know, my husband, the house, a new job, more money in the bank account. If I just get this, I'll be happy. And that's what I did for a long time. I just chased and chased and chased that stuff. And, you know, fast forward a little bit. I don't like to spend a whole lot of time on what it was like. But at 29 years old, I couldn't get out of bed in the morning without taking a drink. My husband was ready to walk out the door. My family was very concerned about me. I had lost several jobs because of my drinking, because I just couldn't get up and get to work. I could not brush my teeth without taking a drink. I had alcohol hidden all over the house because I needed it to survive. And I said, for the first time, I got honest, and I said, I think I have a problem, and I need to stop drinking. And I called my boss, and I told my boss, you know, I think I have a drinking problem. He goes, yeah, I think you do too. I mean, I was coming into the office every day smelling like vodka and running out at lunch every day to get more. So he said, Amy, take all the time you need. Like, just go get yourself some help. And I said, well, I'll be fine. I'll stay at home, and I'm just not going to drink. And I detoxed on my couch at home, not knowing today. Today I know the dangers of that. I didn't know that at the time. And I still remember it was a horrific experience. But after about 3 days, I started to feel better, and I went back to work. And next thing I knew, I was on my way to the hospital in the ambulance because I had a seizure from detoxing. And when I got to the hospital, they were trying to figure out why I had the seizure, and my husband said, well, she just stopped drinking recently. And they said, well, that's why she had the seizure. And so they had, you know, the people from Crisis or whatever come down and give me a bunch of AA pamphlets with 44 questions and all this other junk on it. And I walked out the door and I threw them in the trash. And I had to go to a neurologist just to make sure that's why I had the seizure. And I remember sitting across from the neurologist and him saying to me, Amy, do you think you have a drinking problem? And at this time, like, you know how it talks in our book about, like, we can't remember the pain and suffering or the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And it's a week later, and I'm going, no, I don't think I do have a drinking problem. I think I might have drank a little too much, but I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, come here, I want to show you something. And he took me into the bathroom, and he held my head in front of the mirror. And he said, what color are your eyes? And I said, they're green. And he said, no, what color are the whites around your eyes? And I said, they're white. And he said, no, Amy, they're yellow. And you're 29 years old, and you're going to die from liver failure. And I went home that day and drank. Because there's a part of our book that says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. That means you can't appeal to my emotions. When I am in the midst of this disease, you can tell me I'm going to lose my husband, my house, my job, my kids, whatever. You can tell me I'm going to die, and it does. You cannot appeal to my emotions. The only thing that I need is a drink. And, you know, I went on for a little while longer, and that's when God stepped into my life and did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was just to the point that suicide looked like a really good option because I was sick and tired of hurting everyone around me because I saw the pain in their eyes with me, the disgust, and I just thought, I'm going to drink myself to death. And I locked myself in my house, and I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking. I thought, if I put enough in me, eventually I won't wake up. And every time I woke up, I cursed God for letting me wake up. And I tried to do it again. And after about 3 days of this, I don't remember making this phone call, but apparently I called my mom, and I said, I can't do this anymore, and I need help. And she was over my house in like 5 minutes. She took me to Living Grin, which is a rehab facility in Pennsylvania. And I stayed there for 3 days and detoxed. And then my insurance company apparently wouldn't cover rehab, so they told me that I needed to leave. But the one thing that the counselor said to me before I left there and really tried to drive home was, get yourself to AA. And, you know, they had been saying that to me for the 3 days I was there, and I didn't hear them. But that same day that he was sitting down talking to me, something else happened. A woman came into that detox from Alcoholics Anonymous on a speaking commitment. And she told her story, and it was very similar to mine. And she was not what I envisioned Alcoholics Anonymous to be. And I knew this woman drank like I drank, and today she didn't have to, and that gave me some hope. So when that counselor told me to go to AA, I listened. And I left there on a Thursday night, and I walked into my first AA meeting on Friday morning or Friday afternoon at the 482 Social Hall in Pennsauken, New Jersey. And when I walked in, two women came right up to me. I guess they knew I was new, and they held my hand, and they said, "It's okay, sweetie, you're in the right place." And they walked me over to the table, and they got me a cup of coffee, and they stood there, or they sat there with me and held my hand as I cried. And I am so grateful for that because, you know, I am so into these steps and into, you know, getting through them and doing the work and stuff like that. I sometimes forget what it's like to be a newcomer and the fear that we have when we walk through that door. And when we walk in that door, what we need is love. We need someone to extend their hand and go, you're in a safe place. You know, just come in and sit down. We don't expect anything of you. Because that's what those women did for me. And I was so beaten by alcoholism, I would have done anything they told me to do at that point. And I went to that clubhouse every day and every night for over 90 days. They told me 90 and 90 and all that stuff. They told me to get a sponsor. So this is how I chose my sponsor. It was that first meeting. They said, get a sponsor. And I said, okay. And I said, how do I pick a sponsor? And they said, well, you pick someone that you want what they have. Well, I'm like 3 days sober, right, and sick. So I'm like, okay, I want what they have. So this woman walks in, and she's dressed real nice, and she's got jewelry, and we walk out in the parking lot, and she's driving a Mercedes, and I'm like, I want what she has. Will you be my sponsor? And that was my first sponsor. And she told me to call her every day and not to make any decisions for the first year and all that good stuff that we hear in AA that's nowhere in the big book. But I did what she said. Like I said, I was so willing to do anything at that point. And that's how I stayed sober for 8 years now, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did a lot of other things. God relieved me of my alcohol obsession. But that spiritual malady, that hole in my soul, was still there. And because I didn't ever really work the steps. I mean, let me preface with what I'm about to say. The women that sponsored me and tried to help me did the best they could with the knowledge they had. They weren't trying to hurt me. They were really trying to help me. But no one guided them through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I was told to do steps 1, 2, and 3 until I felt ready to do a 4-step. I was never ready to do a 4-step. And then once I was ready, all it was this big, like, I don't want to curse, complaining session with my sponsor about how the world had wronged me and how everyone treated me unfairly, and that was it. There was no looking at what my role was. My amends were basically, I'm a bunch of I'm sorries. So, you know, I didn't realize it because everyone kept saying to me every year that I got a, you know, every time I got another year sober, I got my coin, I spoke at my home group, everyone clapped, they said what a great job I was doing and how wonderful I was and blah, 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 and off I went. And off I went, and in 8 years of sobriety, that wonderful man that I married that stood by me through everything, I divorced at a year sober because I wasn't happy. And about 60 days later, I met husband number 2 in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And about a year later, we got married. And then we just started on this path of destruction, you know. Basically, it's like this. 8 years sober, 2 husbands, 4 houses, $150,000 in debt, and I steamrolled everyone that I encountered. Because I was so wrapped up in self. There was no God in my life. My prayer life was basically like, God, thank you for keeping me sober. Please give me another day sober tomorrow. That was my prayer life. I went to him as a child with a wish list for Santa. Please let me get this house. Please let me get this job. Please let me be able to pay this bill. Please let me, you know, get this man, whatever the case was. I sponsored people because you told me I had to sponsor people. So how I sponsored people was I ran their lives for them. They called me and I told them what jobs to take, what relationships to be in, what meetings to go to. And meanwhile, I couldn't run my own. And so at 8 years sober, I have a one-year-old daughter. I'm a stay-at-home mom. And my husband, who had 12 years in this program, picked up a drink and couldn't put it down. And this world that I built, there was no God, this world that I built came tumbling down. And I sunk into this depression, and there was nothing that anyone could do for me. This network of women that I had couldn't talk me out of this. No meetings were helping me. And I remember one night, I'll never forget it. It was a Wednesday night. I was sitting out on my porch. My husband at the time was locked in a hotel room just drinking. And I had my one-year-old was upstairs sleeping. And I was envious of my husband. And I wanted to drink. And luckily for me, all the liquor stores closed at 10 o'clock in New Jersey. And it was like 10:05. And I just went to bed, and that next day I walked into a meeting that I had been to previous times, and there was two men there that came over from Philadelphia and did this meeting, and it was a big book meeting, and it was like a big book study. And I had gone there a couple other times and argued with them because they were like telling people to go right through these steps and, you know, immediately start working with others and all this craziness. Like, that was not what I was taught. And I'm like, what are you dudes from Philly coming over to my clubhouse for, like, spewing this nonsense? But on this particular day, I walked in, and the guy running the meeting, who is now my sponsor, saw me and knew something was wrong. And he walked out, and he said, what's up? And I started telling him, just spewing, just like I would do at any other open discussion meeting, like everything that's going on in my life. And he stopped me dead sentence. And he said to me, Amy, who are you helping? And I was like, seriously? Like, did you hear what I just said? Like, I have to help myself. And he said, no, helping yourself will kill you. He said, you have to help other people. You have to take women through this book and get your mind off of you. And I was embarrassed and humiliating that at 8 years sober, I didn't know how. And he said, I'll show you. I'll teach you. And he did. Like I said, my ex-husband now, but my husband at the time was drinking, so I had this one-year-old. So what we would do is we'd get on the phone at night after she went to bed, and he would take me through the book. And he took me through the steps. And the only time we got together was to do my fifth step. So I learned some things going through this process. Number one, I learned what I suffer from. For the longest time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't understand what the disease of alcoholism was. I thought because bad things happened to me when I drank, I was an alcoholic. I knew that when I put alcohol in my system that it kind of took over my body. So I had an idea about the phenomenon of craving, but I didn't understand the mental obsession. I didn't understand that all those years that I sat in AA, why people with 10 and 15 and 20 years relapsed. I didn't understand. But once he showed me in the book where it explains about the mental obsession, you know, our minds paint a delusion or an illusion that's not reality. Our minds will tell us it's going to be different this time, and we believe it with every fiber of our being, you know. And he asked me about my experience with that, and it was my truth. You know, there was countless times I said to my first husband, I am never drinking again, I promise. And a week later, my mind's telling me, you can have a glass of wine, you'll be fine. And then that physical craving's kicked off, and boom, I'm off to the races. So it's like this double-edged sword. And that, for the first time, once he explained the disease of alcoholism, I saw how powerless I was over this disease. You know, I have a mind that tells me I can drink successfully, and I have a body that doesn't let me drink successfully. So I don't want to say the word screwed, but I'm screwed, right? So it shows me exactly how powerless I am. So if I'm powerless, I need some kind of power outside of myself. And it can't be a doorknob, and it can't be a chair. Okay? That power has to come from something bigger, you know? So step two is pretty easy for me. And, you know, it's funny because I just did a meeting last night in Neptune, New Jersey. And they asked me to do this meeting, and I'm going, please don't give me We Agnostics. Please don't give me We Agnostics. They cover like a chapter a week. They gave me We Agnostics. So in doing that meeting, I realized, oh, my gosh, how agnostic I actually was for those 8 years in recovery. I believed in God, but I didn't have faith in God. I didn't experience God. Like, to experience God, I have to get away from self-reliance and start to become God-reliant. I had none of that in my life. When we went through that third step, and they talk about the actor wanting to run the whole show, I saw my life in black and white. Like, that was me. Like, if I can get this man and get this house and arrange this just right, then I'll be happy. You know, that was so me. And then when it tells me what my real problem is, selfishness and self-centeredness, and I'm like, yeah, I don't think that's me, but I'll go along with the rest. See, here was the thing. I didn't truly believe at this point that this was actually going to work for me. I really didn't. My ego was so big. Like, I've been coming around AA for 8 years. I don't think you're going to teach me anything different. Here was the difference. He had something about him that I wanted. He had this light. I saw how he worked with other people and was helpful. And didn't think about himself all the time. And that wasn't me. So I went through the rest of these steps in complete disbelief. So when we got to the fourth step, he had me make my list, my resentments, my fears, my sex conduct. And we sat down and did my fifth step, and this was like no other fifth step I had ever done. Because in the past, my sponsors would just kind of sit there and go, uh-huh, oh, that's a shame, that sucks, you know, that kind of thing. And he's like, yeah, and so where were you selfish? And where were you self-seeking? And where were you dishonest? And where were you inconsiderate? And he helped me and guided me to see the truth about myself. And one of the biggest truths I saw about myself was when I got to my fear list. And when I got to my fear list, there was my two top fears were fear of being alone and fear of financial insecurity. And he turned around to me and he said, Amy, why did you marry the two men you married? And it was right there. Fear of financial insecurity, and fear of being alone. I mean, I didn't steal a pack of gum from Wawa. I stole years from two men's lives that I had no business marrying. None. By the time we got done that fifth step, I was absolutely ready to have God remove these defects of character. So, I think we can complicate six and seven. My take on that is, if you do it an honest enough four and five, you're willing in six. And you're ready to do seven. Because I just wanted to get out of this pain. You know, I sponsor a lot of women, and when they call me and they say to me, I just got done writing, and I'm not feeling real good about myself right now. I'm like, you did a great four step. Because that's what we want. We see the truth about ourselves. Because it really has nothing to do with these other people. It has all to do with me. You know, and it was through that, through three, four, and five, I saw just how self-absorbed I was. It wasn't that I was like this incredibly selfish person. I mean, I was. But I was self-absorbed. When he put it to me that way, Amy, why don't you think of it more as self-absorbed? And he uses this analogy, and I use it all the time because it was very easy for me to understand. He said, Amy, I want you to think about your thoughts on a daily basis and put them in a pie chart. And that pie chart, we're going to break into three pieces. One piece of that pie is going to be your thoughts about yourself. One piece of that pie is going to be your thoughts about God. And the third piece of that pie is going to be your thoughts about other people. What takes up the biggest piece of that pie? That was me. So what happens as a result of these steps is the me part shrinks, the God part gets bigger, and thinking about other people gets bigger.
Don't ask me how it happens, it just does. And, you know, that I'm a control freak. I mean, a freak. And, you know, when he said, like, the whole turning my will and life over to the care of God as I understand him, like, what does that mean? My will and my life, what does that mean? And he said, it means your life's no longer your business and what you want doesn't matter. And that, like, that's how I needed this taught to me. Just like on, you know, the one word he kept using as we were going through this was childlike, Amy. Get childlike. Throw out all these ideas. I'd love that you guys read the Set Aside Prayer because I think it's so important, no matter how long you've been in this program, to throw, like, put aside whatever ideas you think you have. Just put them aside and be willing to experience something new. Whether that's with your recovery, with your fellows, with the God of your understanding, whatever, just be willing to experience something new. And the book uses the word prejudice all through it. And all that means is old ideas. And I had all these old fixed ideas that, as my sponsor pointed out, were killing me. So I had no choice but to change them. Problem was, I couldn't do it on my own power. The book tells me I can have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I can't live up to them even if I wanted to. So I can try to be a kind person. I can try to be accepting. I'll tell you what, if I don't like something, I'm not accepting it. I can say it like going to a meeting, I know acceptance is key. I can say that till the cows come home. If I don't like something, I am not accepting it. I have to have God's help. I am powerless over every aspect of my life. So we get to this point of 6 and 7. I get on my knees and I say the prayer, and he shows me how to make an 8-step list, which, to my surprise, came from my 4-step, because in the past, my 4 steps got burned. It was like this big ritual we did. We went in the backyard and lighted the 4-step, like, don't you feel free now? You know, and everyone's like, yeah. I had one sponsor, bless her heart. She had me tie it to a balloon and let it go. I don't know what the person who found that thought of it, but anyway, so I had this 4-step, and I just transferred the names from the 4-step onto my 8-step list. Pretty easy. And my sponsor said, I want you to do something before you start making this list. I want you to ask God, because now we're on the basis of trust in God instead of an infinite God instead of our finite self. So bring God into everything you do from here. So instead of do this list yourself, bring God into it. So I said a prayer, and I asked God to be with me and to show me what I needed to see. And I started writing, and I started transferring these names over. And as I did, more names started coming up, like names of people that I hadn't thought about in years that I knew I had hurt. And all of a sudden, this list just grew and grew and grew and grew. And so I finished up that list. I call my sponsor, like a good little student, and I'm like, all right, like, what next? Like, when do I start making amends? He's like, yesterday. So he gave me instructions on how to make amends, and he told me I wasn't to use the word I'm sorry, because I'm sorry doesn't mean crap to all these people that I've steamrolled over the years. And I'm to go to these people in sincerity, and I'm to take God with me. And as long as I take God with me, it's going to work out exactly how it's supposed to work out. And I'm to go in and I'm to say, I am wrong. I was wrong, and tell them what I was wrong for. Ask for their forgiveness. Ask them if there's anything else I did to hurt them, because I'm delusional. I may not see some of the things that I did, you know? And then ask them what I can do to make it right. And I usually tell this story. You know, my mom and my dad were, of course, my easiest. And I did them first. And, you know, of course, my mom and my dad are like, Amy, you don't have to do anything. Just stay sober, you know. And the fact was, when I did that 4-step and that 5th step, I saw how selfish I had been with my parents and how I had not been a very good daughter, even in sobriety. You know, my mother lived around the corner from me, and I saw her on holidays. You know, when she picked up the phone, it was like,
I got to talk to her. You know, because I was so wrapped up in self. So I went back to my sponsor, and I'm like, great news. My parents said I don't have to do anything but stay sober. And he's like, no. He's like, Amy, we start practicing these principles in all our relationships. Start being the daughter you haven't been. Pick up the phone and call your mom and ask her how she's doing just because. You know, go over her house. My mom at the time lived down the shore, and I knew that the one thing that my mom loved more than anything was to spend time with myself and my daughter. And so what I did, I wasn't working at the time. Every weekend, I piled my daughter into the car, and I know this sounds like a really hard thing to do, go to the shore every weekend, but when you have a one-year-old, it's not real easy. And there was a lot of times I didn't feel like doing it, but I did. I piled my daughter in her pack and play and her formula and her diapers and everything that goes along with it into the car, and I would drive down to my mom's with my daughter crying the whole way down. And every time my mom, she lives in a condo, and it's two floors, and she's on the second floor, and you can see the parking lot from where her condo is, and she never knew exactly when I was getting down there, but every time I pulled into that parking lot, she was leaning over that railing looking for my car. And she would run down those steps, and she would grab my daughter out of the car, barely say hello to me. And I'd sit there, and I'd watch my mom and my daughter walk away, hand in hand. And I knew how happy that made her, and I would just sit there and thank God. Thank God for taking me out of me enough so I could give this to my mother. And so I went through the rest of my amends. There was one amends that I still haven't made, and not because I don't want to, because going to this person at this time would be completely selfish on my part. And that's something between God and me, and I've also discussed it with my sponsor, so I know it's a decision that I'm just not making on fear, because I could do that and then say it's God coming from God. So other than that, all my amends have been made, and beautiful things have happened through it. You know, old broken relationships have been reestablished, and friendships reborn, and it's wonderful. So I start working 10 in my life every day, you know, and, you know, 10 is my sponsor just kind of gave me a real simple formula, and it's right out of the book. It's watch, ask, discuss, make, help. We watch for these defects of character to crop up. When they do, we ask God to remove them immediately. We discuss it with someone else if we need to. We make amends if we need to, and we turn our attention to someone we can help. And, you know, I'm starting to see a pattern at this point all through the book that it's telling me, like, when there's problems in my life, go out and help other people. And I'm starting to get a little nervous because I know what's coming. And because here's the thing. I hated sponsorship before. Hated it. You were, like, taking time out of my day to call me with your problems du jour. I really didn't want to hear it. I did it because I was supposed to. And it was more of an ego thing. Because it was like, yeah, I got 5 sponsors, and yeah, she just celebrated a year, look what I did. I didn't do anything, but that's how I sponsored, and I really didn't enjoy it. So I wasn't really looking to the whole step 12 thing. So anyway, I'm practicing step 10, God, I always, like, don't leave enough time for 10, 11, and 12. Real quick on step 10, you know, I didn't realize how beneficial it was. Step 10 constantly reveals to me the truth about myself. And there was a decision with my, there was a situation with my ex-husband where we were in a disagreement, and I couldn't see my part. I really couldn't see my part, so I called my sponsor to do a 10 step, and I'm like, you know, what he's doing is wrong, and blah, 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 and I can't see my part. And my sponsor turned around to me, and he said, Amy, you remember your 4 step? I said, yeah. He said, what was the top 2 fears? I said, fear of being alone and fear of financial insecurity. And why did you marry your husband? Because of those fears. We make decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. And it just hit me. And I was like, wow. Like, I constantly have to watch. Again, my mind, my thinking sometimes can be delusional. That's why I need 10 step buddies in my life. I need people in my life that aren't going to co-sign my crap, and are going to be honest with me and not scared to hurt my feelings. And I think that's one of the biggest things my sponsor taught me, is my job as a sponsor today is to be objective. I love what Dave Perry says, I'd rather step on your toes than stand on your grave. If you're going to get mad at me, you're going to get mad at me, but I'm not going to co-sign your crap so you can go out there, be a victim, and drink again. I'm not going to do it. So step 11, prayer and meditation. I had no problem with prayer. There's prayers throughout the book, help guide me along. At this point, I'm feeling God. I'm starting to experience God. You know, step two is came to believe. That insinuates that I'm going to come to believe. In order to do that, I have to go through the rest of this work. So at this point, I'm starting to feel God's power. Meditation. My sponsor was very like, only meditation you need to do is page 86 out of the big book and help others. You know, that's kind of where he was. But I had some other women in my life that kind of opened my eyes up a little more to meditation, which I practice today. And that's my spiritual practice. And these relationships with these other women helps me grow spiritually. They introduced me to some other authors and things like that I like to read that help me get centered in the morning. And I've developed my own spiritual practice that I've come to really enjoy. You know, it's like before I couldn't get my head to shut off. Today I can sit for meditation for 30 minutes, and it's beautiful. I don't start my day without it. You know, I had a speaker one time say, you know, we'll spend an hour in the morning getting ready, picking out clothes that match, and getting breakfast, and getting the kids fed, and taking care of the dogs, and doing all this stuff for the outside, right? But what are we doing for the inside? Like, we can't take some time in the morning to reconnect with this power. We can't take time in the morning to get grounded. And you know, today I do that. I don't go out of the house without meditating and getting close to God. I do my page 86 every night and every morning. That's how I start my day and end my day, along with other spiritual practices. But it's in addition to the program laid out in this book. Step 12. It's my absolute favorite because step 12 saves my life. My problem is I think about myself way too much. You know, I can't fix me. My higher power is doing a fine job of that. Problem is, my mind still thinks about me way too much. When I sit down with another alcoholic, I'm not thinking about myself. You know? When it was time for me, when I was halfway through my amends, my sponsor told me to start going out and trying to find sponsees. And I said the same thing to him that all my sponsees say to me, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I don't know the book like you. I can't do it. I need to go to more book studies. I need to learn more. I'm not ready. Like, maybe I need to go back and do some more inventory, you know? The fact was, it was all fear. It was all fear. If I'm on the basis of trusting God now, where's God in all that? Something happens when you sit down and you open up that book with another person. God comes in. God comes into that room. I know it. I felt it. Look, I started to feel God's power as I went through these steps. But I didn't start to get high on God's power until I sat down with another woman. I remember the first time I sat down. My sponsor, I swear to God, he's a saint. The day I was taking two women through steps 1, 2, and 3. And I called him, and I'm like, I don't know where to go, and what pages do I go to, and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, Amy, write these pages down, and remember this paragraph when we talked about the physical craving, the mental obsession, and he kind of reviewed everything with me, and he's like, look, if you don't know, say, I don't know. It's not that big of a deal. He's like, and Amy, it's an open book test. Open it up, read it. That's it. So I take these two women through steps 1, 2, and 3, and I got my little notes, and I'm going back and forth, and I'm saying, I don't know, but I know what's in here. And anyway, I get them through steps 1, 2, and 3. I give them instructions on writing a 4-step. They are no sooner out the door. I'm on the phone with my sponsor, and I'm like, I get it. I get it. I understand why you work with 40 men taking them through this work. Why? Because I used to say to them, you don't have a life.
Like, you have no life. All you do is sponsor people. I don't get it. Don't you want a social life? Like, don't you want to date and do other things? And he was happy and content living his life, carrying this message. And he does have a life. I was blinded. It just seemed like that's all he did. But I totally got why he did it. I saw it. I felt it. It was undeniable. God had entered my heart at that moment, entered that room, and he was there with us. And I couldn't wait to do it again. When I started all this sponsoring women, I was going through a really tough time in my life. And there's a part in the book, I think it's a Bill story, that it talks about, you know, an alcoholic will not, and I'm paraphrasing, I can never like say it word by word, but an alcoholic will not survive the certain trials and low spots that lie ahead, and I got it backwards, without work and self-sacrifice of others. But basically, it's like when I'm going through something, God puts people in my life to work with. It never fails. It's almost to the point now that when like 20 women come up and ask me to sponsor them, I'm going, oh my, what do you got coming down the pike? Because I know you want my mind off me. But I go with it because he knows. I don't. He holds the blueprints. I just go where I'm directed. The first line of working with others says nothing will ensure immunity against first drink like intensive work with other alcoholics. That's all I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, was immunity from drinking. Intensive work. Not, here's my phone number, call me. That's not intensive work. Intensive work means sitting down with someone new or someone old, because a lot of the women I sponsor today are women just like me that have been sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for years and years and years, and suicide looking like a really good option to them right now because of miserable sobriety. So I sit down with these other women even when I don't feel like it. And my sponsor used to say to me, Amy, step work only counts when it's inconvenient. I hated that. But, you know, it was right. So anyway, at this time when I start sponsoring, I'm going through a bad divorce. I mean, like with the second husband, he can't get sober. It's just, it's an ugly, nasty divorce. I'm filled with fear because I'm a stay-at-home mom. The economy's in the toilet. How am I going to work? How am I going to find a job? How am I going to take care of her? How am I going to pay the bills? Like, so wrapped up in self. And the one thing my sponsor kept saying to me was, go get someone new. Go get someone new. Go. God will. I'm like, how am I going to do this? I have a one-year-old. How am I going to get out of the house to work with these people? He's like, God will figure it out. If God puts them in your life, God will figure it out. And he was right. I had a whiteboard in my kitchen with a calendar, the days of the week on it. And my daughter took a nap every day from 1 to 3, and she went to bed every night at 7 o'clock, like clockwork. And every day of the week, at nap time and at bedtime, I had a woman's name penciled onto that whiteboard to do step work with. Every day of the week. Because that's what God saw that I needed at that time. Did I want to do it all the time? Was I tired at times and just want to take a nap when my daughter took a nap? Yeah. But something happened. I mean, I hear that knock at the door and I'm like, oh, God, I really don't want to do this. Open the door. Hi, come on in. We sit down. We open up that book. And that power comes in. And I'm not thinking about taking a nap. I got chills up my spine right now. I'm not thinking about taking a nap. I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just there with God and this woman. And to see the lights come on in someone else's eyes that has been devastated by this disease, there's no greater reward. There's no greater reward. Working with others is the bright spot in my day. Absolutely. I got to tell you, if I was supposed to hear a fifth step tonight rather than come speak, I would have heard the fifth step. Because it's not about me today. You know, my sponsor, if you haven't guessed this yet, did not mince words. Does not. And he said to me, Amy, if you don't turn around and teach this to someone else, you're nothing but a thief. If you want to stop, he would say, if you want to stop using dope, stop doing dope fiend moves. So if you don't want to continue drinking, stop acting like a thief. Go out and give this away. It was freely given to you. Go give it away. And I want to. I love it. I love working with other people. When I'm wrapped up in self, I don't need to do anything else but sit down with another woman and open up that book. That's it. That's my solution. Go to God for guidance. 10, 11, and 12. I'm going to close with this. There's a second half part of that step, and it's practice these principles in all our affairs. And I'm just learning how to do that. And the biggest one is with my daughter. You know, she's 4 now. 4 and a half, almost 5. And God gave her to me. I couldn't have a child, and God blessed me with an adopted daughter. And I can tell you that I missed the entire first year of my daughter's life. Not because I was drinking, because I was so wrapped up in self. I can't tell you when she said her first word. I can't tell you what it was. I can't tell you how old she was when she took her first step, because I was so wrapped up in me. Trying to figure out what made me happy, because I thought a child would. And then I got the child, and I was still missing something. Today I'm present with my daughter. Absolutely 100% present. When she's outside chasing a squirrel in the backyard, I can sit and watch her for hours. When she comes to me and says, Mommy, come see this, I don't say, wait a minute, I'm making dinner. I go and I see what she wants to show me. That's the biggest gift that I've gotten out of this. I can be there for her. Without this program, without a God of my understanding, without working with other people, I can't be a mother. I can't be a friend. I can't be an employee. I can't be a good human being. This program has taught me to be a good human being that actually cares and has compassion and empathy for other people. And I can't ask for anything greater than that. I've also had this amazing relationship with a higher power that I wasn't even sure I believed in. And today, he's the biggest thing in my life. Thank you all for letting me share.
The group would like to thank Amy for sharing her experience with us tonight. The group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has a working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hands? Thank you. We have one announcement before we close. So basically, one of our home group members last Wednesday celebrated 2 years, Aaliyah. She celebrated 2 years.
Take
so
the
we.
Noise.
Couldn't decide who she wanted to give her coin. I think they're just being kind to me, allowing me to give her coin because I'm just coming back from a relapse. And I just want to say this, like, she talks so much about God and helping others. And before I relapsed, I sponsored Aaliyah. And I've not quite seen some of the things that she's walked through in sobriety. I couldn't even imagine. And I went back out this summer, and I was sitting in, you know, St. Luke's, like, where we go when we drink, and wanting to die, thinking I had no hope, I had no friends. Here comes little Aaliyah, the little girl, sat in the back and wouldn't talk to anybody. Had no hope. Asking me where my big book was. And that's what this program does. And her mom and her little brother are sitting back here tonight, and they're able to heal because that's what God does for us. And I'm really proud of her, and thank you for letting me do the honor and give you your 2 year coin, baby girl. You deserve it.
I'm happy that I have people around here, people like my mom, Lauren, Nicole, all these girls are here to help me through all this. And yeah, I've been through a lot, you know. I've learned that my mom has had breast cancer. I've learned of crazy shit that used to happen to me. I've learned how to deal with life on life's terms and learning to love myself and be there for my mom and my little brother, you know, because this is a family disease. I see my brother as a little me before he picks up that drink. And what he told me a couple months ago, if I ever pick up, will you slap me in the face and tell me to stop? like to me, that's kind of awesome because he doesn't want to see what I've been through because I used to take him wherever I was going, in the car, drunk. Two parties, drunk and high. Like, that was the sister I used to be. But now I'm like, okay, Dave, what's really going on? How are you doing? Are you doing your homework? Your homework. But I'm just happy to be here and alive and not thinking about when I'm going to get my next drink. And I'm happy to be alive and be here. Thanks.